The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to introduce our guest this evening. In her new book, The Patriarchs, science journalist and broadcaster Angela Saini investigates the surprising origins and history of gendered oppression and analyzes contemporary research and revolutionary efforts to combat these systems of control. Her 2017 book, Inferior, challenged the idea that gendered inequality is rooted in our biology. And Superior, in 2019, exposed the lie of race science as it began to creep chillingly back into the mainstream. Her new book likewise shows that the dominant system we have come to accept is neither natural nor inevitable. A recent review in The Guardian calls the book fascinating and insightful. Please welcome Angela Saini to the Free Library.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for coming. This is one of the fundamental questions about humanity, one that crosses all geographical boundaries and stretches back into deep time. How did men come to have so much power? It's a very big question. We're in this age in which we know so much about all the devastating effects of what we call patriarchy. There's an enormous literature, and growing all the time, on gender pay gaps, sexist bias, rates of domestic violence, sexual double standards. We can see the horrific clampdown on women's freedoms all over the world. What we don't do is ask why. Why are things this way? And that's really what I explore in my book and what I wanted to talk to all of you today about. If you have any questions, please keep them, and I want to hear them at the end. I've been on a book tour for the last 3 weeks, and it's been fascinating all over the world to see what it is that certain people find fascinating. So, for example, there are chapters in my book on the Soviet Union, on Iran. I don't cover that in this talk here, but if you're interested in modern-day patriarchy, then please do ask those questions afterwards. It's hard not to imagine that part of the reason that we don't interrogate this question as much as we could, the question of how men came to rule, because we naturalize it. Deep down, we don't always imagine gendered oppression as something that had to have been invented and worked at over time, but something that's always been around in one way or another, an inequality that's kind of rooted in our bodies, that it's always been there, some kind of ineluctable biological difference. The word patriarchy itself has become all-encompassing, monolithic. It feels out of our control, that however much we chip away at it, there'll still be a little bit left at the end. And you can see that idea right the way through not just the scientific literature, but even the feminist literature. This assumption that, you know, when we introduce equality, gender equality, we're doing something new, that this is not something that's ever happened before. In the 20th century, scientists looked at, for example, the chimpanzee, a species that happens to be male-dominated, in which males can be extremely violent towards one another. And we know that this is one of the closest species to us genetically. There are two closest species to us genetically, and the chimpanzee is one of them. So it's no surprise, then, that researchers started to see us in them. It was only much later that researchers began looking more closely at the other species that's equally close to us genetically. And actually, there is now some talk about whether it is even closer to us than the chimpanzee, that threw everything into confusion. So here we have a creature that we imagine, because they are male-dominated, male domination is somehow hardwired into our species. And then we learn that bonobos, another species just as close to us, are actually female-dominated. They're matriarchal. Males among the bonobos rely on their mothers for food and protection. And this has nothing to do with size. Males are slightly larger than the females. But the reason that females dominate here is because females, even when they aren't kin, form very strong bonds with one another. So that's quite unusual in the animal kingdom for creatures to form bonds with other creatures that aren't related to them. But even then, when we consider what we mean by patriarchy in humans, so the word itself, patriarchy, means rule of the father, that's the definition. Father-led rule in that kind of family context is really unusual in other species. You just don't see it, even in other primates. Kin relationships, so the bonds between parents and their offspring, are consistently organized through mothers and their children, not through fathers and their children. So even when we talk about male domination in the species closest to us, we're generally not talking about males dominating females, we're talking about males dominating other males. Chimpanzee females even have their own hierarchy, so you have certain females that move up the group and become more dominant. So in almost every sense, primate male domination in the species closest to us is almost nothing like human patriarchy at all. So what I want for you today is for you to put aside, just for a moment, you don't have to cast it away altogether, but just put to one side for a moment the possibility that male domination is hardwired into our species, and ask yourself what else might explain why things are the way they are now. Whatever evidence is there in history, in archaeology, in anthropology, that might explain why patriarchal societies became so common. This question actually became a very big topic of debate in the middle of the 20th century. So when social movements in Europe and in the US were fighting for freedom, when you saw women's rights activists in the middle of the 19th century, or you saw the big revolutions across Europe in the 18th and 19th centuries, that was when European philosophers and anthropologists first started to ask, maybe it hasn't always been this way. Maybe inequality is something we created. And that's when theories began to emerge asking whether patriarchy might be a product of civilization, not something that's been around forever, but something new. That when humans began to build, for example, more sophisticated settlements and cities or accumulated property, then men must have begun to assert their paternity so they could pass on their wealth and property to their actual children. And that's when they started to control women's reproduction. So this is a very common idea. You see it right throughout feminist literature. The socialist philosopher Friedrich Engels, who you will know co-wrote the Communist Manifesto with Karl Marx, he argued in the 19th century that the world was once female-dominated and then it became male-dominated because of this big catastrophic moment in history when everything changed. And again, that idea that we were all matriarchal once and then we became patriarchal is also common in the literature. In fact, even now, Gloria Steinem, the very famous feminist activist, still cites that. She still says that we were all matriarchal once and then everything changed. Now, we don't have a great deal of evidence for any of these theories. These are just assumptions that we've been living with for almost 200 years. But at the very least, that 19th century debate did seed the possibility that things haven't always been the way they are now. And that's important because over the years then, we have had scholars and researchers and scientists add to that body of knowledge and start to ask more fundamentally, what evidence do we really have for why things are the way they are? One of the first places I visited when I was researching the patriarchs was the very famous Neolithic settlement of Çatalhöyük in southern Anatolia in Turkey. This is you may already have heard of this, this is an incredibly famous place. It was discovered in the 1960s. And when it was excavated, it was described as the oldest city in the world. The reason for that is, number one, it is 9,000 years old. So that is 5,000 years before the first pyramids went up in Egypt. It's 4,000 years before Stonehenge was built. So this is pre-writing, pre-everything you can imagine. Incredibly old and yet incredibly sophisticated. If you go to this site, I mean, I was stunned. You stand at the edge of it. I was stunned, number one, that people hardly ever go there. I was one of the only people there when I visited. But you stand at the edge, and it's cavernous. It goes deep, deep into the ground, all these layers. The houses weren't built the way we build houses now, with pavements in between and doors and windows. There were no doors and windows. Instead, there was a hole in the roof and a ladder, and everybody would have gone in and out of their houses through the roofs in their homes, and the houses were built back to back. So there was no gap between them. And new generations were built on top of the old ones. So this settlement, when you look at it, when you look at the site, looks like a big honeycomb. It's just loads and loads of boxes all piled up around one another. Now, there are aspects to life here that we can recognize. You know, you can see the hearth, you can see the way that people are buried. There are these beautiful, vivid red frescoes on the walls of hunting scenes and vultures preying on dead bodies, bullhorns embedded in the walls. It looks a little bit like a cowboy ranch at times. People have made that comparison. But in many other ways, it was completely different. And one way in which it was entirely different from societies that came much later was that every single measure we have of gender inequality using archaeological data shows us that men and women here 9,000 years ago lived in pretty much the same way. So they spent around the same amount of time indoors and outdoors. They did pretty much the same work. They ate pretty much the same food. They were buried in roughly the same ways. And there are hundreds of female figurines all over this region. In fact, more female figurines than there are male figurines. So women were not invisible either. The most famous figurine from this site is this one, and I apologize for my photography skills, they're terrible, but in real life, it's just astounding. This is the seated woman of Çatalhöyük. She's about as big as my hand, so about this big. Incredibly arresting. Here we have a depiction of what seems to be an older woman, weathered by age a little bit. She has these beautiful big rolls of fat spilling out around her, including on her back, which you can't see very clearly here. She's sitting completely straight, her back is completely straight, and underneath her outstretched hands, underneath each one, is what looks to be a big cat, possibly a leopard. And this is incredible. In the 1960s, when this was found, people didn't know what to make of it. You know, who is this person? Who could she have been? The immediate assumption was that she represented a goddess. But we don't actually know. We actually have no way to recognize who this person was. We don't know any other depictions of her. She could be a real person. But one of the things that one of the archaeologists who led the excavations here in the 1990s told me, Ian Hodder, he said that this was a community in which gender just didn't matter very much. It was very possible that women had authority as well as men having authority, and possibly at certain times women had more authority than men. And that raises a big question. If this is what it was like in at least some parts of the world more than 9,000 years ago, when and why did things change? When did life become more gendered? The problem is that the very evidence that might help us answer that question has itself been clouded by the fact that we don't look at the evidence objectively. We never have. And to some degree, this is understandable. We want the past to be simple. But perhaps even more than that, we want to have our suspicions about it confirmed. Why is it that we feel the need to explain patriarchy in simple ways? Well, because Western academia for so long has been dominated by a certain worldview that scholars assumed, you know, from the 17th, 18th centuries onwards, that women must always have been worse off compared to men from the beginning, and that they always did different work. When we picture the Neolithic, so this is the Stone Age and prior, in our imaginations, we picture cavemen dragging carcasses to their caves where women are kind of nurturing and looking after the children and tending to the food and doing very simple work while the men are doing the big heavy work. It's almost like the Flintstones. It's not very different from that. And this is just a caricature. And yet it's incredible how often that caricature frames the way that archaeologists and anthropologists then think about the evidence that they're presented with. And I'll give you a very quick example here. In 2018, archaeologists in Peru found a human skeleton in the Andes, and it very clearly belonged to a hunter. This hunter was thought to have lived around 9,000 years ago, so this is the same period of time as Çatalhöyük was occupied. The body was thought to have been between 17 to 19 years old when it died, and it was buried with 24 stone objects, including projectile points and a knife. So immediately, archaeologists knew this is the body of a hunter buried with all their hunting toolkit. Until that skeleton turned out from analysis to be female, and experts were shocked. They didn't hide their surprise. One archaeologist told National Geographic magazine, and he hadn't been involved in this research or in the analysis afterwards, but he told the magazine, "You can't just stop in the middle of stalking a deer in order to nurse a crying baby." Which is remarkable, because what does that imply? It implies that all young women throughout evolutionary history have never done anything except nurse crying babies. What else could they have done? We have lots of evidence from other prehistoric burials and much later that women do hunt. They are fighters. They have held positions of power. And in fact, an analysis was done after this discovery of all the hunter burials across the Americas from this time period and earlier, and we have an equal number of male and female hunters. So we cannot say, on the evidence we have now, maybe later we will be able to, but right now we cannot say that big game hunting was a gendered activity in this period of time because we simply don't have the evidence for it. The military historian Pamela Toller has written that women warriors and hunters are very far from being rare exceptions in history, but for some reason they still sit so lightly on our consciousness. We still don't integrate them into the way that we think about gender in the past. It's increasingly clear that powerful women have existed on almost every continent for thousands of years. So much later than that Peruvian skeleton, just in the middle at the top here, we have Kubaba. This was female Sumerian king from 2500 BCE. She wasn't a king by virtue of being the relative of someone in the royal family. She was a tavern keeper who became a king in her own right. The evidence for women sharing power and status with men in history is just irrefutable, especially the further back you go. The question we shouldn't be asking is why. The question we should be asking is why does that surprise us? Why should we be shocked by that? And the answer, of course, is because it doesn't fit with how we imagine the past. We imagine the past to be patriarchal, so these women must be exceptions even in their own time, even though there are so many of them. Even with all the counter-evidence we have, that underlying idea that the past was always patriarchal doesn't change. It's only now, because of social change in our own societies, because of cultural change, that we're finally starting to be able to look at evidence in different ways, especially as women have entered archaeology and anthropology in larger numbers. And when we start looking at history in that more objective way, without the baggage of our own preconceptions, it looks completely different from how you imagine. So the very first signs of human inequality that we see in the data are not between women and men, they're between men. We know, using modern-day genetic data, that in Europe at least, but also in parts of Asia and Africa, there were signs of social tension emerging sometime between 7,000 and 5,000 years ago. So this is thousands of years after Çatalhöyük was occupied. And one of the forms that tension took was that far smaller numbers of men were having more children than most other men, or at least male children who were surviving into generations into the present day. Geneticists call this a bottleneck. So this is a genetic bottleneck, and it still affects us today. On the maternal side, we don't see that same bottleneck among women. So it wasn't the case, it has never been the case, that fewer women were having more children than most other women. It was just on the male side. Now, what does that tell us? It's hard to say exactly, because we don't have written evidence from that time. It happened over many thousands of years. It didn't happen suddenly. It could be that war and conflict were killing off lots of men, so there were fewer men left to have the children. Or it could be a sign of social hierarchies developing between men, that there was an elite class of men emerging who were just having many more children than other men, which is a phenomenon we still recognize from the present day, that the wealthier you are, or the more powerful you are, the more children you're likely to have, although that's not a hard and fast rule. It's much later, though, So even though this was happening, it's very much later that we see gender depression, laws starting to restrict the lives and freedoms of women. And when that happens, again, like I said, much, much later, it's with the rise of the state. So often you will hear or you will read in feminist literature, people say that patriarchy begins in the family, that it starts with the father ruling over his family and then that kind of radiating outwards into the society and then into the state. And actually the evidence shows it to be exactly the other way, that it started with the state and then it radiates into the family. And the reason I say that is that this is when you see, with the emergence of these big states in areas like ancient Mesopotamia and Assyria, states starting to control how families live. And the reason they did that was because their big preoccupation was population. Just imagine, you are creating a state for the first time. How do you get people to stay there? How do you get people to work for you, to produce a surplus so that the richest people in your society, the ones who govern everything, can have more than other people? That is a really difficult problem for the elites in those early states. Unlike now, you know, it's a difficult thing for us to imagine because these days we are born into a state and you become a citizen automatically. But it wasn't like that before. People could just leave. They could be hunter-gatherers. They could move wherever they wanted. So that population question was a huge one. And this is why states started to take an interest in the family. First of all, because you need people to have more children so you can raise your population. Number two, you need people to be loyal to you so that they will defend the state if necessary, even give up their lives for the state if necessary. And those two twin preoccupations, population, birth rates, and defense are still an issue for states now. Anywhere in the world, when birth rates start to fall, states get nervous, countries get nervous, governments start bringing in legislation to change things. The very first country in the world, very first state in the world to legalize abortion in modern times was the Soviet Union in 1920. But even there, when birth rates started to fall, Stalin reversed that. So even though they had a commitment to gender equality, when they realized the birth rates are falling, even they reversed the decision to legalize abortion. So again, these are features that we can recognize for modern times. And we can see it in the practice of conscription or national service, your duty as a citizen to defend the state and to have children. We still describe women who don't have children as selfish. Why are they selfish? Who are they not serving here by not having children? They're not serving society. They're not serving the state. So you can see here how and why states became concerned with the family, with marriage, with reproduction, and in turn, how that led to concern about gendered roles. That if young women are expected to have more children, their place is having babies at home. And if young men are expected to fight, then their role is a public one, a militaristic one. And this is where we first start to get these ideas of femininity and masculinity that we recognize in our modern day stereotypes. These very rigid ideas about what is appropriate for men and women, for boys and girls. Later, that morphs in some states, in antiquity particularly, into a fear that society might break down if people transgress these rules. That the state's sanctity is invested in how people behave within their families, their sexual behavior. So the sanctity of the state then is wrapped up in social behavior. These are the origins of the first patriarchal states. But again, it would be a mistake to imagine that women lost all power immediately when the first states emerged. That didn't happen. It happened incredibly slowly, over many, many thousands of years. Even the narrowest reading of history doesn't show that some single catastrophic moment changed everything. Instead, what we see is this kind of gradual negotiation, weeding its way into laws, later into religions, and even then in a piecemeal way, depending on where you are in the world. So at the far end here, you can see an Assyrian marriage and divorce certificate in a museum from around 2,000 years ago. And it does show that there were gendered laws at that time, but in this certificate, you can see a man and a woman negotiating their rights to divorce. For equal rights to divorce, something that women thousands of years later wouldn't have. So even then, there is room for movement and a kind of back and forth, not just between the state and the family, but within families. And to give you an example of just how much variation there still was in ancient history for thousands of years, I want to give you an example from an even more recent era, the Mongol Empire. Temujin, or Genghis Khan, is one of those patriarchs who did have many more children than most other men. And actually, we can see that in the genetic data. One in every 200 men alive today have a direct ancestor who lived around 1,000 years ago. And experts, scholars, think that one ancestor may have been Genghis Khan. The reason they say that is because he is known to have had 23 official wives, hundreds of concubines, depending on the historical sources you're using, and he passed that legacy onto his sons and grandsons over generations. So they also had many more wives, many more concubines, and many more children for generations. Genghis Khan is one obvious example of patriarchal power. He is a patriarch that we can track through scientific data, historical data, and through written evidence. But even in the Mongol Empire, as patriarchal as it was, women still had a huge amount of power and agency. They worked, they rode horses as well as the men, according to many accounts. They were talented archers, and archery continues to be practice that's that is not gendered in that part of the world even now. They were famous for being strong, for being involved in trade, even androgynous in appearance, according to some outside observers. So when outsiders came in and saw how Mongol women were living, they were shocked. They couldn't believe that they had these kind of public lives. The historian Frank McLean has written that there was, and this may be apocryphal, it probably is, but there was a particular admiration for the way that they could give birth standing up and then carry on with their work as though nothing had happened. And high-status Mongol women also did seize the reins of power at certain points in time. For example, if a son was too young to take control, or if a husband or a father was away. Genghis Khan's own great-great-granddaughter apparently, and again this might be apocryphal, apparently insisted that any man who wanted to marry her had to first beat her in wrestling. And according to legend, she beat 1,000 men who tried to beat her in wrestling. So we can see that the boundaries of gender, the boundaries of power, were being worked out for a very long time, for thousands of years in different parts of the world, even while the elites and even while the patriarchs were consolidating their power. The story of how we get to what we've seen in the last few hundred years, these kind of rigid binary laws that have so much power over how we live, our governmental institutions, our bureaucracy, that comes much later. You know, this idea that a woman's right to vote should be restricted, that she shouldn't be able to work in the professions, have a public life, own property after marriage, keep her own earnings after marriage, that idea is a widespread one. We see it in ancient Greece, but ancient Athens was an anomaly even in its own time. The reason it became widespread is much, much later. It developed in a much more fractured way than we think. And what you might be wondering now is, if societies were becoming more socially unequal, why is it that women weren't the ones to take power rather than men? Why didn't we develop matriarchies instead of patriarchies? Well, one of the problems for human societies is that we face a difficult choice in how we marry. It's not a good idea for people to keep marrying within their own community over generations for obvious reasons. It's better for us to look a bit further than that. And that means in many parts of the world, people practice some kind of movement when it comes to marriage. And there are lots of different ways you can do that. Sometimes the men leave, sometimes the women do. But patrilocal societies are those in which the women tend to move away from their own childhood homes when they get married and live with their husbands' families. And this can be devastating. And I would argue that this form of patrilocal marriage is a necessary condition for patriarchy. Without it, you just cannot have that degree of control of women or male power that you see otherwise. When women leave their families to live with their husbands' families, they become almost like strangers. They're like foreign agents inside a new community. So they become immediately, that separation immediately makes them more vulnerable to exploitation and abuse. Meanwhile, for the men who are staying in their own families over generations, it's easy for them to form tight networks with each other because they're with their fathers and their brothers and their sons over generations. The women just don't have that kind of opportunity. And ultimately, the key to power, which we should know from the bonobos, is how much support we have from others around us. That is it. We only need to look around to know that the most powerful people in our society are not the physically strongest. You know, it's not like WWE wrestlers are running the world. It's the oldest men, generally. It's the people who can form the tightest, strongest networks and alliances with each other. And that's true not just for our own species, but also for primates. If you look at chimpanzees, the alpha male is not always the biggest and strongest. Other primates don't like to be bullied or intimidated. It's often the one who is able to build networks with others, build trust among other people. The question is, how much support do we give to who? And in patrilocal societies, of course, women don't have those sources of support, so it's almost impossible for them to form those networks. In antiquity, it was so common for women to not just move to live with their husbands, but to be forcibly taken in these patrilocal communities, that there's even a passage in the Old Testament book of Deuteronomy that is a kind of instruction manual for men on what to do in these situations. The passage says, "Bring her into your home, have her shave her head, trim her nails, put aside the clothes she was wearing, and after she's lived in your house and mourned her father and mother," because this is someone who is captured in war, so her family will have been killed, "then you may go to her and be her husband." The brutal practice of seizing young women and girls and then forcibly marrying them continues even today. Since 2014, thousands of schoolgirls have been abducted in Nigeria by the militant group Boko Haram, many of them raped and married to their captors. Also in 2014, Islamic State militants took thousands of Yazidis from northern Iraq, forcing some of them into religious conversion and marriage, and many of them have been bought and sold as slaves afterwards. The legacy of taking captives as wives also survives culturally in different forms in the modern-day ritual of bride abduction. In fact, you could even argue that in marriage, when we talk about a father giving away the bride, that in itself is an echo of that patrilocal tradition. But in parts of Central Asia, particularly Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan, in Armenia and Russia, and in parts of Ethiopia, Somalia, and Indonesia, there is this ritual of bride abduction that's still practiced, in which women are either symbolically or literally kidnapped to be married. Although these days, often in these regions, this is just a ritual for show. So the couple will have agreed that they will get married, and that the bride abduction ritual is just a kind of demonstration, a way to keep up a custom or a tradition. But what that tradition does betray is a history in which brides were literally kidnapped into patrilocal marriage. When we arrive much later in modern states, the laws regulating marriage simply build on this model of the wife essentially being a captive or a slave in her own family. There's this constant assertion that the wives are the property of their husbands. In England, it took until 1839 for women to even have the right to petition for the custody of their own children. That if you left your husband, your children didn't belong to you, they belonged to him. In France, until 1907, a married woman would see whatever wages she earned go straight to her husband because her labor didn't belong to her, it belonged to her husband. As recently as 1965, a French husband could legally stop his wife from working. It's only relatively recently that even marital rape has been categorized as a crime, and in some countries it still isn't considered a crime, which essentially condones violence within the family. The late, brilliant sociologist Fatima Mernissi wrote about patriarchal families in Morocco in the 1970s, and she also observed that a daughter-in-law was expected to be deferential not just to her husband, but also his entire family, especially her mother-in-law. And mother-in-laws, we underestimate this, especially in kind of more societies that tend to have nuclear families like the United States, but in many parts of the world where people still live in extended family homes, that mother-in-law, daughter-in-law dynamic is absolutely crucial to upholding patriarchal systems. Mernesi noticed just how much power these mother-in-laws had, especially when it came to controlling how their sons felt. In the most traditional households, it was the wife's duty to kiss her mother-in-law's hand every day and call her Lala, meaning mistress, which again is the language of slavery. She wrote, Mernesi wrote, his mother is the only man, a woman a man is allowed to love at all. Because again, it is in the mother-in-law's interest to keep that bond between her and her son in order to be able to exercise control over the wife. So you can see here how women were also drawn into the webs of patriarchal power, becoming upholders of it at the same time as being its victims. But of course, and I do have to stress this here, not all marriages are patriarchal or patrilocal. This isn't universal. Just because patriarchy is common, that doesn't mean it's everywhere. The freedom, power, and agency we have in marriage is mediated in our circumstances. And of course, you know, I should add here, I'm very happily married. And the reason I'm happily married is because of the laws and rules that we now have that regulate our lives as husbands and wives and citizens, and also what we negotiate within our own circumstances. But historically, too, patrilocal marriage has just been one system out of many. There are others. In matrilocal and matrilineal families, where women don't leave their childhood homes to get married, things look completely different. The balance of power between men and women can look completely the opposite. I only have one illustration in my book, and it's this map. It's a map of the known existing matrilineal societies in the world as documented by anthropologists. So these are societies in which inheritance is traced through mothers rather than fathers. And as you can see, there are a lot of them, particularly in Africa. So that entire swathe of Africa is known as the matrilineal belt. Across Asia, and in many indigenous communities across the Americas, this is very common, matrilineal and matrilocal customs. Over time, the world has become more socially homogeneous. And again, this is a present map. So historically, you would have seen many more than this. So this is just today, the societies that we have today. Over time, the world has become much more flattened out, if you like. We have a small handful of major religions. We have only a small number of ways in which we imagine that societies can be organized. We've all begun to converge. And part of the reason for that is the spread of cultural ideas, the spread of patriarchy through empire and colonialism. Not just European empires more recently, but at various points through history, Greek, Roman, Islamic, Mongol, the list goes on, right throughout the world. New York state history is actually a perfect example of how that spread of patriarchal customs has happened. And this is a history that is a living one. There are people who can remember this. So this is why it's so useful, especially for me as a journalist, but also for anthropologists. If we want to understand how patriarchy happens, we don't have to look very far. We can look within our own environs, within our own history. If you go upstate from New York City, I live in New York City, but after a few hours, you hit Seneca Falls, which is very famous. It's a small town where the world's first women's rights convention was held in 1848. And the town is a kind of testament to that. It's become a pilgrimage site for many women's rights activists. I went there myself. There are memorials and paintings everywhere dedicated to that big moment in 1848 when these huge leaders of the women's rights movement all came together, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Lucretia Mott, they're very famous figures. But the story hidden away in the background of all of this is that in 1590, so this is way before the United States was even founded, Seneca Falls was where Haudenosaunee women, indigenous women, met to demand peace among their nations. And the reason they were able to do that is because they already held a great deal of power within their communities. In Haudenosaunee origin stories, life began with a woman. And to this day, clan mothers still help run everything at the local level of government. They are traditionally matrilineal, so name and property is passed from mother to daughter rather than from father to son. When Europeans encountered Haudenosaunee, or Iroquois people as they were known then, this came as a huge shock. As far as they were concerned, they were building in the United States a society that was at the cutting edge of modernity. This would be the most egalitarian, equal place on the planet. And that's how women's rights activists at that time framed their struggle. They said that if we really want to be modern, then we have to give women the vote, then we have to give women more power. So how could they square that with the fact that here were societies that for hundreds of years already had even more than what they were asking for, where women had so much authority already? And the answer they came up with, not the women's rights activists, but philosophers like Friedrich Engels, anthropologists like Henry Lewis Morgan, was to say, well, the reason that they are female-centered is because they are primitive. They belong to the past, we belong to the future. In these societies, men just haven't wised up yet. They haven't figured it out yet. Once they figured it out, then they would naturally become patriarchal because that's the way things always are. And so what was their answer? Their answer was to civilize indigenous Americans into patriarchy, which is exactly what they did. Over centuries, they sent young children to boarding schools where girls were taught to be housewives. They were pulled out of agriculture. So women generally ran agriculture in these societies. They were pulled out of that and told, your place is at home. And boys were taught to do agriculture and be the heads of their households. Women were told for the first time, you can't name your children after yourself. You have to name them after the father of your children, which was a huge imposition, completely changing the way that things were done. In fact, this was such a huge change in how people thought about themselves, that when young children were taught by Christian missionaries the Lord's Prayer, they were taught thy father and thy mother, they subconsciously, automatically changed that when they sang it to thy mother and thy father. They couldn't imagine a world in which the mother wasn't the primary person within their families. And this continued for decades, this kind of chipping away at matrilineal customs, at the ways that in which people lived, by telling them that they were backward, that they belonged to the past, that if they wanted to be part of modern American society, then they would have to be patriarchal because this is how people lived. We can see a similar decline in another matrilineal society on the other side of the world, this time in India. So this is where I have my family heritage. This is where my parents were born and grew up. In the southern state of Kerala, centered around the kingdom of Travancore, is a traditionally matriarchal society, the Nayars, where families lived in these huge extended matrilineal households known as Taravads. So these big extended families in which the eldest female was the head of the household. And this legacy is actually one reason that's given for why Kerala still has such high rates of female literacy to this day. For as long as records have been kept, women and men have had almost the same rates of literacy and much, much higher than everywhere else in India, and very high rates of education. And it's a very comfortable place to travel if you're a woman on your own compared to other parts of India, which are very rigidly patriarchal. The historian Manu Pillai has written that Nayar women always had the security of the homes they were born in throughout their lives and were not dependent on their husbands. He adds, they were effectively at par with men when it came to sexual rights. They had complete freedom in that sense. But again, this horrified British authorities in India. They did everything possible to undermine the authority of Nayar households throughout the 19th and 20th century, to the extent that the queen of Travancore was told that she couldn't rule, that she could only be regent until her son was older. But of course, people didn't pay any attention to that. This was the 19th century, and people just treated her like the queen anyway. It was just the British authorities that didn't recognize her. This combined with people being told, you are backward. Matrilineal customs are backward. To have women in this much power is backward. Eventually, that began to take a cultural toll on people. Young men began to travel and start to ask, well, if there are patriarchal societies here, maybe we can have that kind of power. Why shouldn't we inherit the property of our parents? the cultural dial shifted. And it wasn't violent. It wasn't particularly violent. It was bit by bit, over many decades, hundreds of years, gradually changing laws, gradually changing customs, changing how people thought, until, you know, they were on board with it. It was 1976, so after the end of colonialism in India, that the Kerala legislature abolished matrilineal altogether. It had become so convinced that this was not a system for them. Those big, beautiful Taravads, these huge family homes in which, you know, so many dozens of people would live, they started to fall into disrepair by the 1990s. They were sold off. What I want to emphasize here is two things. Social change doesn't happen like a thunderbolt. It never has. It comes in slowly, creeping, until we ourselves don't even know what we've lost until it's gone. And secondly, that while we might imagine patriarchy to be thousands of years old, and it is in some parts of the world, for many other parts of the world, it is only a couple of hundred years old. In fact, it's still within living memory. In the end, then, patriarchy is not some kind of indestructible monolith that's just been bulldozing through our lives. It's a slow grift, and it's a grift that continues to this day. Every time you see leaders, whatever they are, political or religious leaders, social leaders, twisting things, manipulating things in order to take your rights away, they are recreating patriarchy. They are building it again. They're not reviving anything. They're not reaching into the past, because the past has always been varied. They're creating it afresh every single time. And when we recognize that, when we have a measure of it, I hope we can also see it as a more fragile and precarious thing. It is not inevitable. We don't have to live with it. It's perfectly within our power to change everything. Thank you. And I'm happy to take some questions now.
So I always understood patriarchy as evolving from the Engels perspective that you shared, that it's very much tied to private property and wanting to keep that in a secure line. And it sounds like your perspective is that that's a little bit besides the point, that there's more of, that it's more a flex of just state power and power in general. I was just wondering if you could clarify that a little bit. Like, is it more of a modern development that the desire to keep private property in this chain of succession came about?
You know, Engels took a lot of his inspiration from the Haudenosaunee, from the Iroquois. So he read Henry Louis Morgan's writings, for instance. So when he wrote about the family and the state, he bought into this idea that matriarchy was the primitive way, the way that we had always lived, and that we became suddenly patriarchal. So in Engels' words, there was this world historical defeat of the female sex, and that's when everything changed. And he linked that to property. The problem is, of course, that Henry Louis Morgan's construction was a racist one. It assumed that Native Americans belonged to the past, that they were not modern people at all. And of course, they were equally modern. They had just designed their, organized themselves in a completely different way. So that was always fraught. That was always problematic. And the other thing, of course, is that we see agriculture for a very long time. We see property for a very long time before we see gendered rules emerging. We only really see gendered rules with the development of the first states. We have agriculture for a long time. And in fact, if you look at this, it's a seated woman. This is a settlement in which we have a mix of things. We have some people hunting and gathering, but we also have domestication, plant and animal domestication. And here is a woman clearly in charge of two animals here, involved in that process of animal domestication, possibly, if this is what that represents. And we see that all over the world. In fact, subsistence farming is still a female-run activity in most parts of the world. I travel a lot as a reporter. When I go, you know, last time I was in Kenya, I was covering local farms there. The head of every single farm I visited was a woman. And that's true in many parts of the world. It's actually a very Western idea that agriculture is a male thing and that a woman's place is in the home. That is a construction that isn't universal by any stretch of the imagination. So, yes, there were issues with the way that Engels framed everything. And part of the reason he framed it that way, of course, is because it suited his wider argument around class and property. That's not to say that property doesn't matter. It does. Income, wealth, and property do matter. They are vehicles for patriarchal power and gendered control now. They were in the 19th century, and they continue to be now. But that doesn't mean that that's where patriarchy began. And the reason I say that is just the evidence doesn't suggest that. The historical evidence, the timelines don't match up.
I know you had said that patriarchy is something that comes over a long period of time, and it made me think about Iran and how you had a society where there was much more equality, and then suddenly it was taken away in a very short period of time. And I wonder if you could comment on that and how that's gone forward and everything.
Yeah, it's interesting. The last chapter of my book is on the 1979 revolution in Iran. And I wrote that before the protests started to happen. So it's been really fascinating for me to see what's been happening over the last year and put that in the context of what happened 40 years ago. Because the 1979 revolution was also a popular one. You know, women were out in the streets. Socialists were out in the streets. Everyone was. The difference then, of course, was that the Shah was seen as a Western figure. That one, part of the problem that Iranians had with him was that he was relying so much on foreign control. He was, in their minds, selling off the country to these kind of Western ideas about modernity. He had mandated that women couldn't wear the veil. So what you see in 1979, as people were marching in the streets, women start adopting the veil, even the chador, this kind of all-encompassing garment, in solidarity with poorer and more rural women, in which that was still a tradition, and as a way to assert their criticism of the Shah, to say that these are our traditions, how dare you take our traditions away? We want an authentic way to be Iranian. We want modernity, we want equality, but we also want to maintain our sense of being Iranian. The issue was that the Shah had been so successful at quashing all forms of opposition before him. In some cases, he co-opted women's rights activists into the government. So we do see prominent Iranian women in the 1970s in government, a small number. He slowly and very gradually gave women the vote. And of course, he brought in all these reforms that meant that women were starting to be educated more. They worked in the professions. You could wear what you want. If you went to Tehran in the 1970s, you would see women in short skirts and their hair and makeup, you know, looking like women in New York. And because he had quashed all other forms of opposition, all that was left by 1979 was the religious conservatives. They had to remain because there is no way that he could have got rid of them. And even though Khomeini was in exile, he became the automatic successor because there was nobody else. And what did he bring in immediately? Despite what he said along the way, immediately he brought in this very conservative Islamic Republic that took away all of these rights that women had. And that was a big shock. This is why we have so many Iranians in exile in the United States today, you know, huge communities of professionals who left the country because they were so disillusioned by what happened, and in many cases scared for their lives. You know, they were fleeing a regime that was clamping down on them in horrific ways, sending children to young people to prison. So they ended up with exactly the opposite. And what we don't ask now in 2023 is if the same thing were going to happen now. You know, in 1979, women were adopting the veil as a sign of resistance. Today, they're doing exactly the opposite. They're taking it off because this conservative regime has mandated the veil. The Shah was still a patriarch. This regime, they are also patriarchs. All they did was exchange one patriarchy for another, a different form. And the question we don't ask now is if this revolution or if these protests were to turn into a revolution, if everything were to be overturned, what would replace it? I've not seen that anywhere in any coverage of Iran. What would replace it? We cannot take for granted that just because there's a popular revolution, you will end up with something more liberal and progressive, because that is not the lesson of history of the last 100 years. And that's slightly what I worry about, is that we treat progressive politics and liberalism as an inevitability, that we are always moving that direction. If anything, we should know, I mean, we should recognize here in the United States more than anywhere else, that is not a given. You have to build it, you have to make the case for it, and you have to design that opposition in order to take power. Great. If there's no more questions, then thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.